Behavior is determined by our impressions of what is the correct thing to do, based on what we observe others doing. This influence is known as social proof. The company instrumentalizes this aspect of adolescent nature by using messages from friends to make a product, service, or activity feel more personal and emotional. This ubiquitous tactic, much admired by Pentland, was used in the Facebook voting experiment. It fuels young people's needs to garner approval and avoid disapproval by doing what the others are doing. Facebook's single most momentous innovation in behavioral engineering is the now equally ubiquitous like button, adopted in 2009. According to contemporaneous blog posts by longtime Facebook executive Andrew Bosworth, the like button had been debated internally for more than a year and a half before Zuckerberg's final decision to incorporate it. He had rejected the idea more than once, fearing that it would detract from other features intended to lift monetization, such as the controversial Beacon program. Significantly, the founder embraced the button only when new data revealed it as a powerful source of behavioral surplus that helped to ratchet up the magnetism of the Facebook news feed, as measured by the volume of comments. Facebook's leadership appears to have realized only gradually that the button could transform the platform from a book into a blizzard of mirrors, a passive read into an active sea of mutual reflections that would glue users to their news feeds. On the supply side, the like button was a planet-size one-way mirror capable of exponentially increasing raw material supplies. The more that a user liked, the more that she informed Facebook about the precise shape and composition of her hand, thus allowing the company to continuously tighten the glove and increase the predictive value of her signals. The protocols at Instagram, a Facebook property, provide another good example of these processes. Here, one sees these tight linkages, as compulsion draws more surplus to feed more compulsion. Instagram rivets its users with photos that appeal to their interests. So how does it select those photos from the millions that are available? The obvious but incorrect answer would be that it analyzes the contents of photos that you like and shows you more. Instead, Instagram's analytics are drawn from behavioral surplus, the shadow text. As one manager describes it, you base predictions off an action, and then you do stuff around that action. Actions are signals like following, liking, and sharing, now and in the past. The circle widens from there. With whom did you share? Who do they follow, like, and share with? Instagram is mining the multi-layered social web between users, but that mining is based on observable, measurable behaviors moving through time. The dynamic surplus of the shadow text, drawn from its own caches as well as Facebook's, not the content displayed in the public text. In the end, the photos you see resonate with strange relevance for your life. More begets more. On the demand side, Facebook's likes were quickly coveted and craved, morphing into a universal reward system, or what one young app designer called our generation's crack cocaine. Likes became those variably timed dopamine shots, driving users to double down on their bets every time they shared a photo, web link, or status update. A post with zero likes wasn't just privately painful, but also a kind of public condemnation. In fact, most users craved the reward more than they feared humiliation, and the like button became Facebook's signature, spreading across the digital universe and actively fusing users in a new kind of mutual dependency, expressed in a pastel orgy of giving and receiving reinforcement. The like button was only the start of what was to be an historic construction of a new social world that for many users is defined by fusion with the social mirror, especially among the young. Just as gamblers chase the zone of fusion with the machine, a young person embedded in the culture of mutuality chases the zone of fusion with the social mirror. For anyone already struggling with the challenge of the self-other balance, the like button and its brethren continuously tip the scales toward regression. The short history of Facebook's newsfeed is further evidence of the efficacy of the ever-tightening feedback loops that aim to shape and sustain this fusion. When newsfeed was first launched in 2006, it transformed Facebook from a site where users had to visit friends' pages to see their updates to having those messages automatically shared in a stream on each person's homepage. Hundreds of thousands of users joined opposition groups, repelled by the company's unilateral invasion of privacy. No one was prepared for their online activity to suddenly be fodder for mass consumption, recalled the tech news site TechCrunch on Newsfeed's 10th anniversary in 2016, as it offered readers the ultimate guide to the newsfeed, with instructions on how you can get your content seen by more people, how to appear prominently, and how to resonate with your audience. 10 years earlier, a TechCrunch reporter had presciently noted, "Users who don't participate will quickly find that they are falling out of the attention stream, and I suspect will quickly add themselves back in." Playing to the fear of invisibility and abandonment worked in 2006, when Facebook had just 9.5 million users and required a college email address to sign up. And it has driven the acceptance of every subsequent tweak to Newsfeed, as Facebook has amassed more than 2 billion users. Newsfeed grew to become the epicenter of the corporation's revenue success and the most valuable billboard on Earth, as Time magazine stated in 2015, just 3 years after Facebook's IPO. Newsfeed is also the fulcrum of the social mirror. In the years between revulsion and reverence, Newsfeed became Facebook's most intensely scrutinized object of data science and the subject of extensive organizational innovation, all of it undertaken at a level of sophistication and capital intensity that one might more naturally associate with the drive to solve world hunger, cure cancer, or avert climate destruction. In addition to Facebook's already complex computational machinery for targeting ads, by 2016, the newsfeed function depended upon one of the world's most secretive predictive algorithms, derived from a God view of more than 100,000 elements of behavioral surplus that are continuously computed to determine the personal relevancy score of thousands of possible posts as it scans and collects everything posted in the past week by each of your friends, everyone you follow, each group you belong to, and every Facebook page you've liked, writes Will Oremus in Slate. The post you see at the top of your feed, then, has been chosen over thousands of others as the one most likely to make you laugh, cry, smile, click, like, share, or comment. The glove tightens around the hand with closed feedback loops enabled by the God view, which favors posts from people with whom you have already interacted, posts that have drawn high levels of engagement from others, and posts that are like the ones with which you have already engaged. In 2015, the See First curation tool was introduced to channel direct data on the shape of a user's social mirror by soliciting his or her personal priorities for the newsfeed. Facebook's chief product officer describes the corporation's interest in supplying what is most meaningful for you to know today from everything that happened on Earth, published anywhere by any of your friends, any of your family, any news source. Each post sequenced in the newsfeed also now hosts a range of explicit feedback options. I want more of this, I want none of that. These direct surplus supply lines are important sources of innovation aimed at broadening the target of the fusion zone, increasing the tenacity of an ever-tightening glove. In 2016, Facebook's product director confirmed that this direct sourcing of surplus led to an increase in overall engagement and time spent on the site. Facebook's science and design expertise aim for a closed loop that feeds on, reinforces, and amplifies the individual user's inclination toward fusion with the group and the tendency to overshare personal information. Although these vulnerabilities run deepest among the young, the tendency to overshare is not restricted to them. The difficulty of self-imposed discipline in the sharing of private thoughts, feelings, and other personal information has been amply demonstrated in social research and summarized in an important 2015 review by Carnegie Mellon professors Alessandro Acquisti, Laura Brandimarte, and George Lowenstein. They concluded that because of a range of psychological and contextual factors, people are often unaware of the information they are sharing, unaware of how it can be used, and even in the rare situations when they have full knowledge of the consequences of sharing, uncertain about their own preferences. The researchers cautioned that people are easily influenced in what and how much they disclose. Moreover, what they share can be used to influence their emotions, thoughts, and behaviors. The result is alteration in the balance of power between those holding the data and those who are the subjects of that data. Facebook has Pentland's prized God view on its side, an unparalleled resource that is drawn upon to remake this naturally longed-for fusion into a space of no escape. Science and capital are united in this long-game project. Yesterday it was the like button. Today it is augmented reality, and tomorrow there will be new innovations added to this repertoire. The company's growth in user engagement, surplus capture, and revenue are evidence that these innovations have hit their marks. Young people crave the hive, and Facebook gives it to them. But this time it's owned and operated by surveillance capital and scientifically engineered into a continuous spiral of escalating fusion, amply fulfilling Schaefer's 5 criteria for achieving an addictive state of compulsion. Potency is engineered according to a recipe dictated by the hidden attributes of those who crave valorization from the group to fill the void where a self must eventually stand. These cravings may not be the sole motivations of Facebook's currently 2 billion users, but they aptly describe the attributes upon which Facebook's incentives are designed to bite the hardest. Climbing the mountain of the self-other balance is an adventure that we each must undertake. A journey of risk, conflict, uncertainty, and electrifying discovery. But what happens when the forces of surveillance capital turn the mountain into a mountain range? Look at us. Yes, you are alive. Do not look away. Why would you? How could you? Today we might like you. 4. The next human nature. A growing body of evidence testifies to the psychic toll of life in the hive, where surveillance capital's behavioral engineering expertise collides with the centuries-in-the-making human impulse towards self-construction. Researchers are already providing answers to 2 key questions. What are the psychological processes that dominate the hive? What are the individual and societal consequences of these processes? According to the 302 most significant quantitative research studies on the relationships between social media use and mental health, most of them produced since 2013, the psychological process that most defines the Facebook experience is what psychologists call social comparison. It is usually considered a natural and virtually automatic process that operates outside of awareness, effectively forced upon the individual by his social environment, as we apply evaluative criteria tacitly internalized from our society, community, group, family, and friends. As one research review summarizes, almost at the moment of exposure, an initial holistic assessment of the similarity between the target and the self is made. As we go through life being exposed to other people, we naturally compare ourselves along the lines of similarity and contrast. I am like you. I am different from you. Subliminal perceptions that translate into judgments. I am better than you. You are better than I. Researchers have come to appreciate the way in which these automatic human processes converge with the changing conditions of each historical era. For most of our human history, people lived in small enclaves and were typically surrounded by others very much like themselves. Social comparisons with little variation are unlikely to entail great psychological risk. Research suggests that the diffusion of television in the second half of the 20th century dramatically increased the intensity and negativity of social comparison, as it brought vivid evidence of varied and more affluent lives dramatically different from one's own. One study found an increase in criminal larceny as television diffused across society, awakening an awareness of and desire for consumer goods. A related issue was that increased exposure to television programs depicting affluence led to the overestimation of others' wealth and more dissatisfaction with one's own life. Social media marks a new era in the intensity, density, and pervasiveness of social comparison processes, especially for the youngest among us, who are almost constantly online at a time of life when one's own identity, voice, and moral agency are a work in progress. In fact, the psychological tsunami of social comparison triggered by the social media experience is considered unprecedented. If television created more life dissatisfaction, what happens in the infinite spaces of social media? Both television and social media deprive us of real-life encounters, in which we sense the other's inwardness and share something of our own, thus establishing some threads of communality. Unlike television, however, social media entails active self-presentation, characterized by profile inflation, in which biographical information, photos, and updates are crafted to appear even more marvelous in anticipation of the stakes for popularity, self-worth, and happiness. Profile inflation triggers more negative self-evaluation among individuals as people compare themselves to others, which then leads to more profile inflation, especially among larger networks that include more distant friends. As one study concluded, expanding one's social network by adding a number of distant friends through Facebook may be detrimental by stimulating negative emotions for users. One consequence of the new density of social comparison triggers and their negative feedback loops is a psychological condition known as FOMO, fear of missing out. It is a form of social anxiety defined as the uneasy and sometimes all-consuming feeling that your peers are doing, in the know about, or in possession of more or something better than you. It's a young person's affliction that is associated with negative mood and low levels of life satisfaction. Research has identified FOMO with compulsive Facebook use. FOMO sufferers obsessively check their Facebook feeds during meals, while driving, immediately upon waking or before sleeping, and so on. This compulsive behavior is intended to produce relief in the form of social reassurance, but it predictably breeds more anxiety and more searching. Social comparison can make people do things that they might not otherwise do. Facebook experiments and Pokemon Go's augmented reality each exploit mutual visibility and its inevitable release of social comparison processes for successful tuning and herding. Both of these illustrate the ways in which once natural psychological processes are repurposed to heighten the effectiveness of Pentland's vaunted social pressure, thus enabling behavior modification at scale. Social pressure is activated by "I want to be like you," as the risks of difference and exclusion threaten negative social comparison. What do we know about the mental health consequences of social comparison as it ensnares Facebook users, especially the young? Most of the research aimed at a deeper grasp of cause and effect in the user experience has been conducted with college-age participants, and even a brief review of a few key studies tells a grim tale, as adolescents and emerging adults run naked through these digitally mediated social territories in search of proof of life. A 2011 study found that social media users exposed to pictures of beautiful users developed a more negative self-image than those who were shown less attractive profile pictures. Men who were shown profiles of high career status men judged their own pursuits as inadequate, compared to others who saw profiles of less successful men. By 2013, Researchers found that Facebook use could predict negative shifts in both how their young subjects felt moment to moment, as well as their overall life satisfaction. That year, German researchers found that the astounding wealth of social information presented on Facebook produces a basis for social comparison and envy on an unprecedented scale. Their work demonstrated that passive following on Facebook exacerbates feelings of envy and decreases life satisfaction. More than 20% of all recent experiences of envy reported by the students in the research study had been triggered by Facebook exposure. A three-phase investigation in 2014 found that spending a lot of time browsing profiles on Facebook produced a negative mood immediately afterward. Then, upon reflection, those users felt worse, reckoning that they had wasted their time. Instead of walking away, they typically chose to spend even more time browsing the network in the hope of feeling better, chasing the dream of a sudden and magical reversal of fortune that would justify past suffering. This cycle not only leads to more social comparison and more envy, but it can also predict depressive symptoms. The self-objectification associated with social comparison is also associated with other psychological dangers. First, we present ourselves as data objects for inspection, and then we experience ourselves as the it that others see. One 2014 study demonstrated the deleterious effect of these loops on body consciousness. An analysis of young men and women who had used Facebook for at least 6 years concluded that, regardless of gender, more Facebook participation leads to more body surveillance. A sense of self-worth comes to depend on physical appearance and being perceived as a sex object. Body shame leads to constant rounds of manicuring self-portrayals for a largely unknown audience of followers. Life in the hive favors those who most naturally orient toward external cues rather than toward one's own thoughts, feelings, values, and sense of personal identity. When considered from the vantage point of the self-other balance, positive social comparisons are just as pernicious as negative comparisons. Both are substitutes for the hard bargain of carving out a self that is capable of reciprocity rather than fusion. Whether the needle moves up or down, social comparison is the flywheel that powers the closed loop between the inclination toward the social mirror and its reinforcement. Both ego gratification and ego injury drive the chase for more external cues. Over time, studies increase in complexity as they try to identify the underlying mechanisms through which social comparison in social media is associated with symptoms of depression and feelings of social isolation. One notable 3-year study published in 2017 considered both the direct Facebook data of more than 5,000 participants, as well as self-reported data on their real-world social networks. This approach enabled ongoing direct comparisons between real-world relationships and Facebook associations across 4 domains of self-reported well-being: physical health, mental health, life satisfaction, and body mass index. Liking others' content and clicking links to posts by friends, the researchers summarized, were consistently related to compromised well-being, whereas the number of status updates was related to reports of diminished mental health. So strong was this relationship that a 1 standard deviation increase in likes clicked, links clicked, or status updates was associated with a decrease of 5% to 8% of a standard deviation in self-reported mental health, even controlling for a person's initial state of well-being. The researchers' definitive conclusion? Facebook use does not promote well-being. Individual social media users might do well to curtail their use of social media and focus instead on real-world relationships. 5. Homing to the herd. This is not a rehearsal. This is the show. Facebook is a prototype of instrumentarian society, not a prophecy. It is the first frontier of a new societal territory, and the youngest among us are its vanguard. The frontier experience is an epidemic of the viewpoint of the other one, a hyper-objectification of one's own personhood shaped by the relentless amplification of life lived from the outside looking in. The consequence is a pattern of overwhelming anxiety and disorientation in the simple act of digital disconnection, while connection itself is haunted by fresh anxieties that paradoxically leave too many feeling isolated, diminished, and depressed. One wants to say that the struggles of youth can be painful in any era, and that it is simply the destiny of today's young people to encounter the work of self-construction in this milieu of digital connection and illumination, with its truly marvelous opportunities of voice, community, information, and exploration. One wants to say they will get through it, just as other generations survived the adolescent trials of their time and place. But this time, it is not a question of simply packing their lunch and crossing our fingers as they head into the school day maze of adolescent cliques, or sending them off to college knowing that they may stumble or fall, but eventually find their passions and their people as they find themselves. This time, we have sent them into the raw heart of a rogue capitalism that amassed its fortune and power through behavioral dispossession, parlayed into behavior modification in the service of others' guaranteed outcomes. They crave the hive just as Hall's teenagers did in 1904, but the hive they encounter is not the unadulterated product of their natures and their culture of mutuality. It is a zone of asymmetrical power, constructed by surveillance capital as it operates in secrecy beyond confrontation or accountability. It is an artificial creation designed in the service of surveillance capital's greater good. When young people enter this hive, they keep company with a surveillance priesthood. The world's most sophisticated data scientists, programmers, machine learning experts, and technology designers, whose single-minded mission to tighten the glove is mandated by the economic imperatives of surveillance capital and its laws of motion. Innocent hangouts and conversations are embedded in a behavioral engineering project of planetary scope and ambition that is institutionalized in Big Other's architectures of ubiquitous monitoring, analysis, and control. In their encounter with the self-other balance, teenagers step onto a playing field already tilted by surveillance capital to tip them into the social mirror and keep them fixed on its reflections. Everything depends upon feeding the algorithms that can effectively and precisely bite on him and bite on her and not let go. All those outlays of genius and money are devoted to this one goal of keeping users, especially young users, plastered to the social mirror like bugs on the windshield. The research studies and first-person accounts that we have reviewed reveal the coercive underbelly of the instrumentarian's much-revered confluence, in which harmonies are achieved at the expense of the psychological integrity of participants. This is the world of Pentland's social learning, his theory of tuning little more than the systematic manipulation of the rewards and punishments of inclusion and exclusion. It succeeds through the natural human inclination to avoid psychological pain. Just as ordinary consumers can become compulsive gamblers at the hands of the gaming industry's behavioral technologies, psychologically ordinary young people are drawn into an unprecedented vortex of social information that automatically triggers social comparison on an equally unprecedented scale. This mental and emotional milieu appears to produce a virus of insecurity and anxiety that drives a young person deeper into this closed loop of escalating compulsion as he or she chases relief in longed-for signals of valorization. This cycle unnaturally exacerbates and intensifies the natural orientation toward the group. And although we all share in this disposition to varying degrees, it is most pronounced in the stages of life that we call adolescence and emerging adulthood. Ethologists call this orientation homing to the herd, an adaptation of certain species, such as passenger pigeons and herring, that home to the crowd rather than to a particular territory. In the confrontation with human predators, however, this instinct has proven fatal. For example, biologist Bernd Heinrich describes the fate of the passenger pigeons whose social sense was so strong that it drew the new predator, technologically equipped humans, from afar. It made them not only easy targets, but easily duped. Commercial harvesters followed the pigeons' flight and nesting patterns, and then used huge nets to catch thousands of pigeons at a time, shipping millions by rail each year to the markets from St. Louis to Boston. The harvesters used a specific technique designed to exploit the extraordinary bonds of empathy among the birds and immortalized in the term stool pigeon. A few birds would be captured first and attached to a perch with their eyes sewn shut. As these birds fluttered in panic, the flock would descend to attend to them. This made it easy for the harvesters to catch and slaughter thousands at once. The last passenger pigeon died in the Cincinnati Zoo in 1914. The pigeon had no home boundaries over which to spread itself and continued to orient only to itself so it could be everywhere, even to the end. To the pigeons, the only home they knew was in the crowd, and now they had become victims of it. The lack of territorial boundaries of human predators had tipped the scales to make their adaptation their doom. Facebook, social media in general, these are environments engineered to induce and exaggerate this homing to the human herd, particularly among the young. We are lured to the social mirror, our attention riveted by its dark charms of social comparison, social pressure, social influence. Online all day. Online almost all day. As we fixate on the crowd, the technologically equipped commercial harvesters circle quietly and cast their nets. This artificial intensification of homing to the herd can only complicate, delay, or impede the hard psychological bargain of the self-other balance. When we multiply this effect by hundreds of millions and distribute it across the globe, what might it portend for the prospects of human and societal development? Facebook is the crucible of this new dark science. It aims to perfect the relentless stimulation of social comparison in which natural empathy is manipulated and instrumentalized to modify behavior toward others' ends. This synthetic hive is a devilish pact for a young person. In terms of sheer everyday effectiveness, contact, logistics, transactions, communications, turn away and you are lost. And if you simply crave the fusion juice that is proof of life at a certain age and stage, turn away and you are extinguished. It is a new phenomenon to live continuously in the milieu of the gaze of others, to be followed by hundreds or thousands of eyes, augmented by big others' devices, sensors, beams, and waves rendering, recording, analyzing, and actuating. The unceasing pace, density, and volume of the gaze deliver a perpetual stream of evaluative metrics that raise or lower one's social currency with each click. In China, these rankings are public territory, shiny badges of honor and scarlet letters that open or shut every door. In the West, we have likes, friends, followers, and hundreds of other secret rankings that invisibly pattern our lives. The extension and depth of exposure include every data point, but necessarily omit the latency within each person, precisely because it cannot be observed and measured. This is the latency of a possible self that awaits ignition from that one spark caused by the caring attention of another embodied human being. It is in that clash of oxygen and ember that the latent is perceived, comprehended, and yanked forward into existence. This is real life, fleshy, soft, uncertain, and replete with silence, risk, And when fortune smiles, genuine intimacy. Facebook entered the world bypassing old institutional boundaries, offering us freedom to connect and express ourselves at will. It is impossible to say what the Facebook experience might have been had the company chosen a path that did not depend upon surveillance revenues. Instead, we confront the sudden accretion of an instrumentarian power that spins our society in an unanticipated direction. Facebook's applied utopistics are a prototype of an instrumentarian future, showcasing feats of behavioral engineering that groom populations for the rigors of instrumentarianism's coercive harmonies. Its operations are designed to exploit the human inclination toward empathy, belonging, and acceptance. The system tunes the pitch of our behavior with the rewards and punishments of social pressure, herding the human heart toward confluence as a means to others' commercial ends. From this vantage point, we see that the full scope of the Facebook operation constitutes a vast experiment in behavior modification designed not only to test the specific capabilities of its tuning mechanisms, as in its official large-scale experiments, but also to do so on the broadest possible social and psychological canvas. Most significantly, the applied utopistics of social pressure, its flywheel of social comparison, and the closed loops that bind each user to the group system vividly confirm Pentland's theoretical rendering of the case. Instrumentarian social principles are evident here, not as hypotheses, but as facts. The facts that currently constitute the spaces where our children are meant to grow up. What we witness here is a bet-the-farm commitment to the socialization and normalization of instrumentarian power for the sake of surveillance revenues. Just as Pentland stipulated, these closed loops are imposed outside the realm of politics and individual volition. They move in stealth, crafting their effects at the level of automatic psychological responses and tipping the self-other balance toward the pseudo-harmonies of the hive mind. In this process, the inwardness that is the necessary source of autonomous action and moral judgment suffers and suffocates. These are the preparatory steps toward the death of individuality that Pentland advocates. In fact, this death devours centuries of individualities. 1. The 18th century's political ideal of the individual as the repository of inalienable dignity, rights and obligations. 2. The early 20th century's individualized human being called into existence by history, embarking on Machado's road because she must, destined to create a life of one's own in a world of ever-intensifying social complexity and receding traditions. And 3. The late 20th century's psychologically autonomous individual whose inner resources and capacity for moral judgment rise to the challenges of self-authorship that history demands and act as a bulwark against the predations of power. The self-authorship toward which young people strive carries forward these histories, strengthening, protecting, and rejuvenating each era's claims to the sanctity and sovereignty of the individual person. What we have seen in Facebook is a living example of the third modernity that instrumentarianism proffers, defined by a new collectivism owned and operated by surveillance capital. The God view drives these computations. The computations enable tuning. Tuning replaces private governance and public politics, without which individuality is merely vestigial. And just as the uncontract bypasses social mistrust rather than healing it, the post-political societal process that bind the hive rely on social comparison and social pressure for their durability and predictive certainty, eliminating the need for trust. Rights to the future tense, their expression in the will to will, and their sanctification in promises are drawn into the fortress of surveillance capital. On the strength of that expropriation, the tuners tighten their grasp and the system flourishes. Industrial capitalism depended upon the exploitation and control of nature, with catastrophic consequences that we only now recognize. Surveillance capitalism, I have suggested, depends instead upon the exploitation and control of human nature. The market reduces us to our behavior, transformed into another fictional commodity and packaged for others' consumption. In the social principles of instrumentarian society, already brought to life in the experiences of our young, we can see more clearly how this novel capitalism aims to reshape our natures for the sake of its success. We are to be monitored and telestimulated like McKay's herds and flocks, Pentland's beavers and bees, and Nadella's machines. We are to live in the hive, a life that is naturally challenging and often painful, as any adolescent can attest. But the hive life in store for us is not a natural one. Men made it. Surveillance capitalists made it. The young people we have considered in this chapter are the spirits of a Christmas yet to come. They live on the frontier of a new form of power that declares the end of a human future with its antique allegiances to individuals, democracy, and the human agency necessary for moral judgment. Should we awaken from distraction, resignation, and psychic numbing with Scrooge's determination, it is a future that we may still avert. 6. No Exit. When Samuel Bentham, brother of philosopher Jeremy, first designed the Panopticon as a means of overseeing unruly serfs on the estate of Prince Potemkin in the late 18th century, he drew inspiration from the architecture of the Russian Orthodox churches that dotted the countryside. Typically, these structures were built around a central dome, from which a portrait of an all-powerful Christ Pantocrator stared down at the congregation and, by implication, all humanity. There was to be no exit from this line of sight. This is the meaning of the hand and glove. The closed loop and the tight fit are meant to create the conditions of no exit. Once it was no exit from God's total knowledge and power. Today it is no exit from the others, from Big Other, and from the surveillance capitalists who decide. This condition of no exit creeps on slippered feet. First, we do not even have to look away, and later, we cannot. In the closing lines of Jean-Paul Sartre's existential drama, No Exit, the character Garçon arrives at his famous realization, "Hell is other people." This was not intended as a statement of misanthropy, but rather a recognition that the self-other balance can never be adequately struck as long as the others are constantly watching. Another mid-century social psychologist, Irving Goffman, took up these themes in his immortal The Presentation of Self in Everyday Life. Goffman developed the idea of the backstage as the region in which the self retreats from the performative demands of social life. The language of backstage and onstage, inspired by observations of the theater, became a metaphor for the universal need for a place of retreat in which we can be ourselves. Backstage is where the impression fostered by performance is knowingly contradicted, along with its illusions and impressions. Devices such as the telephone are sequestered for private use. Conversation is relaxed, truthful. It is the place where vital secrets can be visible. Goffman observed that in work, as in life, control of the backstage allows individuals to buffer themselves from the deterministic demands that surround them. Backstage, the language is one of reciprocity, familiarity, intimacy, humor. It offers the seclusion in which one can surrender to the uncomposed face in sleep, defecation, sex, whistling, chewing, nibbling, belching, and flatulence. Perhaps most of all, it is an opportunity for regression in which we don't have to be nice. The surest sign of backstage solidarity is to feel that it is safe to lapse into an asociable mood of sullen, silent irritability. In the absence of such respite, where a real self can incubate and grow, Sartre's idea of hell begins to make sense. In a classroom of undergraduates, students discuss their strategies of self-presentation on Facebook. Scholars refer to these as chilling effects. The continuous curation of one's photos, comments, and profile with deletions, additions, and modifications, all of it geared to the maximization of likes as the signal of one's value in this existential marketplace. I ask if this 21st century work of self-presentation is really that much different from what Goffman had described. Have we just traded the real world for the virtual in constructing and performing our personas? There is a lull as the students reflect, and then a young woman speaks. The difference is that Goffman assumed a backstage where you could be your true self. For us, the backstage is shrinking. There is almost no place left where I can be my true self. Even when I'm walking by myself and I think I am backstage, something happens. An ad appears on my phone or someone takes a photo and I discover that I am on stage and everything changes. The everything that changes is the sudden cognizance, part realization and part reminder, that big other knows no boundaries. Experience is seamlessly rendered across the once reliable borders of the virtual and real worlds. This accrues to the immediate benefit of surveillance capital. Welcome to McDonald's. Buy this jacket. But any worldly experience can just as immediately be delivered to the hive. A post here, a photo there. Ubiquitous connection means that the audience is never far, and this fact brings all the pressures of the hive into the world and the body. Recent research has begun to turn to this dour fact that a team of British researchers describes as the extended chilling effect. The idea here is that people, especially, though not exclusively, young people, now censor and curate their real-world behavior in consideration of their own online networks, as well as the larger prospect of the internet masses. The researchers conclude that participation in social media is profoundly intertwined with the knowledge that information about our offline activities may be communicated online, and that the thought of displeasing imagined audiences alters our real-life behavior. When I catch myself wanting to cheer the students who are anguished by connection and terrified of its loss, I consider the meaning of no exit as recounted in a personal recollection of the social psychologist Stanley Milgram regarding an experiment that demonstrated the power of immediate circumstances on feelings and behavior. Milgram's class was studying the force with which social norms control behavior. He had the idea of examining the real-life phenomenon by having his students approach a person on the subway and, without providing any justification, simply look the person in the eye and ask for his or her seat. One afternoon, Milgram himself boarded the subway, ready to make his contribution. Despite his years of observing and theorizing disturbing patterns of human behavior, it turned out that he was unprepared for his own moment of social confrontation. Assuming that it would be an easy caper, Milgram approached a passenger and was about to utter the magical phrase, when the words seemed lodged in my trachea and would simply not emerge. I stood there, frozen, then retreated. I was overwhelmed by paralyzing inhibition. The psychologist eventually hectored himself into trying again. He recounts what occurred when he finally approached a passenger and choked out his request. "Excuse me, sir, may I have your seat?" A moment of stark, anomic panic overcame me. But the man got right up and gave me the seat. Taking the man's seat, I was overwhelmed by the need to behave in a way that would justify my request. My head sank between my knees, and I could feel my face blanching. I was not role-playing. I actually felt as if I were going to perish. Moments later, the train pulled into the next station and Milgram exited. He was surprised to discover that as soon as he left the train, all the tension disappeared. Milgram left the subway, where he vibrated in tune with the others, and that exit enabled a return to his self. Milgram identified three key themes in the subway experiment as he and his students debriefed their experiences. The first was a new sense of gravitas toward the enormous inhibitory anxiety that ordinarily prevents us from breaching social norms. Second was that the reactions of the breacher are not an expression of individual personality, but rather are a compelled playing out of the logic of social relations. The intense anxiety that Milgram and others experienced in confronting a social norm forms a powerful barrier that must be surmounted, whether one's action is consequential, disobeying an authority, or trivial, asking for a seat on the subway. Embarrassment and the fear of violating apparently trivial norms often lock us into intolerable predicaments. These are not minor regulatory forces in social life, but basic ones. Finally, Milgram understood that any confrontation of social norms crucially depends upon the ability to escape. It was not an adolescent who boarded the subway that day. Milgram was an erudite adult and an expert on human behavior, especially the mechanisms entailed in obedience to authority, social influence, and conformity. The subway was just an ordinary slice of life, not a capital-intensive architecture of surveillance and behavior modification, not a personalized reward device. Still, Milgram could not fight off the anxiety of the situation. The only thing that made it tolerable was the possibility of an exit. Unlike Milgram, we face an intolerable situation. Like the gamblers in their machine wombs, we are meant to fuse with the system and play to extinction. Not the extinction of our funds, but rather the extinction of ourselves. Extinction is a design feature formalized in the conditions of no exit. The aim of the tuners is to contain us within the power of immediate circumstances as we are compelled by the logic of social relations in the hive to bow to social pressure exerted in calculated patterns that exploit our natural empathy. Continuously tightening feedback loops cut off the means of exit, creating impossible levels of anxiety that further drive the loops toward confluence. What is to be killed here is the inner impulse toward autonomy and the arduous, exciting elaboration of the autonomous self as a source of moral judgment and authority, capable of asking for a subway seat or standing against rogue power. Inside the hive, it is easy to forget that every exit is an entrance. To exit the hive means to enter that territory beyond, where one finds refuge from the artificially tuned-up social pressures of the others. Exit leaves behind the point of view of the other one, in favor of entering a space in which one's gaze can finally settle inward. To exit means to enter the place where a self can be birthed and nurtured. History has a name for that kind of place. Sanctuary.
Chapter 17. The Right to Sanctuary. Refuge and prospect are opposites. Refuge is small and dark. Prospect is expansive and bright. We need them both, and we need them together. Grant Hildebrand, Finding a Good Home, Origins of Architectural Pleasure. 1. Big Other Outruns Society. That summer night when our home was destroyed by a lightning strike, we watched in the driving rain as the gables and rambling porches exploded in fire. Within hours, a smoldering field of black ash covered the ground where home had been. In the months and years that followed, my recollections of the house took an unexpected shape. Less rooms and objects than shadow, light, and fragrance. I conjured in perfect clarity the rush of my mother's scent when I opened the drawer filled with her once cherished scarves. I closed my eyes and saw the late afternoon sun slicing through the velvety air by the bedroom fireplace, with its ancient sloping mantle where our treasures were on display. A photo of my father and me, heads tilted toward each other, blending our two shocks of curly black hair. The miniature painted enamel boxes discovered in a Parisian flea market years before the thought of motherhood, which later became the shelter for our children's milk teeth, huddled like secret caches of seed pearls. It was impossible to explain the quality of this sadness and longing, how ourselves and the life of our family had evolved symbiotically with those spaces that we called home. How our attachments transformed a house into a hallowed place of love, meaning, and commemoration. My difficulty began to ease only when I discovered the work of Gaston Bachelard, an extraordinary man who had been a postal worker, physicist, philosopher, and ultimately a professor of philosophy at the Sorbonne. The old house, for those who know how to listen, is a sort of geometry of echoes. The voices of the past do not sound the same in the big room as in the little bedchamber. Among the most difficult memories, well beyond any geometry that can be drawn, we must recapture the quality of the light. Then come the sweet smells that linger in the empty rooms. One of Bachelard's work in particular, The Poetics of Space, is instructive as we reckon with the prospects of life in the no-exit shadow of Big Other and its power brokers behind the curtain. In this book, Bachelard elaborates his notion of topoanalysis, the study of how our deepest relationships to inner self and outer world are formed in our experience of space, specifically the space we call home. The house shelters daydreaming. The house protects the dreamer. The house allows one to dream in peace. The house is one of the greatest powers of integration for the thoughts, memories, and dreams of mankind. It is body and soul. It is the human being's first world. Before he is cast into the world, man is laid in the cradle of the house. Life begins well. It begins enclosed, protected, all warm in the bosom of the house. Home is our school of intimacy, where we first learn to be human. Its corners and nooks conceal the sweetness of solitude. Its rooms frame our experience of relationship. Its shelter, stability, and security work to concentrate our unique inner sense of self, an identity that imbues our daydreams and nightdreams forever. Its hiding places, closets, chests, drawers, locks, and keys satisfy our need for mystery and independence. Doors, locked, closed, half shut, wide open, trigger our sense of wonder, safety, possibility, and adventure. Bachelard plumbs not only the imagery of the human house, but also of nests and shells, the primal images of home that convey the absolute primitiveness of the need for a safe refuge. Well-being takes us back to the primitiveness of the refuge. Physically, the creature endowed with a sense of refuge huddles up to itself, takes cover, hides away, lies snug, concealed. A human being likes to withdraw into his corner. It gives him physical pleasure to do so. The shelter of home is our original way of living in space, Bachelard discovers, shaping not only the existential counterpoint of home and away, but also many of our most fundamental ways of making sense of experience. House and universe, refuge and world, inside and outside, concrete and abstract, being and non-being, this and that, here and elsewhere, narrow and vast, depth and immensity, private and public, intimate and distant, self and other. Our family instinctively pursued these themes in imagining a new home. When we were finally able to undertake that project, we foraged for durable natural materials. Old stone and scarred wooden beams that had weathered the storms of time. We were drawn to old furniture that had already lived many lives, composing others' homes. This is how the walls of the new house came to be massive,
nearly a foot deep and packed with insulation. The result is just as we had hoped, a lush and peaceful stillness. We know that nothing guarantees safety and certainty in this world, but we are comforted by the serenity of this home and its layered silences. The days unfurl now within the embrace of these generous walls, where once again our